You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hello, everyone. This is MLB.com Extras, American League Central Edition. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz. Thanks for tuning in. The Central received a major shakeup in advance of this week's non-waiver trade deadline with the Royals' acquisition of Johnny Cueto. So we'll talk to Jeffrey Flanagan on that bold move. And, of course, there are other big deadline decisions to be made in Detroit and on the south side of Chicago with David Price and Jeff Samardzija, two of the particularly attractive trade chips. So we'll talk to Jason Beck about the Tigers situation and Scott Merkin about the White Sox. We'll also get Rhett Bollinger's thoughts on a Twins team having a rough second half so far, but still very much in the mix for an AL wildcard spot. And we'll hear from Jordan Bastion about the Indians, whose own players are calling them out for a lack of fight. So obviously a lot to cover this week. Let's not waste another minute with my babbling. Let's get to it.
I'm here with Jeffrey Flanagan. We're just outside the visitor's dugout at Progressive Field, where the Royals and Indians are playing a three-game set this week. Won't see Johnny Cueto in this series, but we'll be seeing him Friday, it sounds like. And, boy, first of all, if you're just thinking the grand context of the Kansas City Royals making a major deadline acquisition of this magnitude, you know, selling major farm system pieces, just something you didn't see in those 29 years between playoff appearances. Great to see it now.
Yeah, it is. It's pretty exciting. It tells you a couple things about how dedicated that David Glass and Dayton Moore are to getting back to the World Series and trying to win it. And also tells you what faith they have in their scouting department that they'll reload the draft and keep being able to acquire pieces because they have depth in the farm system. They gave away three pretty good prospects, but as Dayton always says, I mean, if you're worried about who you're going to give up, you're never going to get a deal done. So they're at the stage now where they can afford they've got enough depth in the farm system, they can afford to make these moves. It's pretty exciting, and it's probably going to be a two-month rental, but it really, I think, gives them the edge in the AL right now.
Cueto, of course, you know, he's an elite arm. We know this. The one concern I have is, you know, well, he doesn't have the postseason pedigree of some people that you might like to see, but and then, of course, the injury situation. You know, he's had a couple starts pushed back this year, but he really, I think he showed a lot of people a lot of, with that last start in Colorado, especially under the circumstances of first being informed he's traded
right
before he even goes out on the mound, and then he delivers such a quality outing on top of that. So that seemed to alleviate some concerns there. Obviously, the Royals were pushing for him even before that trade, but I think industry-wide, you know, that made people feel a lot better about what the Royals are getting.
Yeah, and the Royals actually, several people told me earlier in the week, too, that they were have complete faith that he was healthy, that he was going to be fine, he could take the ball every fifth day. And I mean, there's an excited group of guys in the clubhouse right now to get him. He'll show up tomorrow. And they're also excited that what he can do, maybe do at Kauffman Stadium, which is, as you know, a lot bigger ballpark. Right. He's kind of a fly ball guy. Amazingly, he's kept his ERA this low, you know, pitching in a bandbox like Cincinnati. Yeah. Now he's going to be pitching in front of maybe the best defense in baseball and a big ballpark, not just now, but in the playoffs, too. So that's another reason why they're very excited. You know, a guy with that low of an ERA, now you put him in front of that defense in that ballpark. It's going to be pretty formidable for opponents. As Ned said, it's a bad day for opponents yesterday because Ventura pitched well, and they got Cueto. So.
Oh, you think? And Cueto's reunited with his old buddy Edinson Volquez.
Yep.
And you think now about this trio with Ventura, the way he pitched on Sunday, and Volquez and Cueto, the Dominican threesome there.
Yeah.
Little guys from the Dominican who can do a lot of damage for this club. But how big was that to see Ventura? He had a weird week, obviously. He's sent down to AAA, yeah. Then Vargas gets hurt, so he busts the U.E. and comes back. And was just dominant and outpitched Dallas Keuchel.
Yeah, he really did. I mean, it was the kind of the Ventura that we saw last year, a guy that's not afraid to pitch to contact. And he had no walks, gave up six hits, no balls really particularly smashed, but just, you know, had faith in his breaking stuff, faith in his fastball, made the Astros put the ball in play, used his defense, and gave him seven strong innings. And well, really were sweltering conditions there. It was 110 heat index, and he made it through seven. It's exactly what Ned and his staff wanted from him, and maybe he's turned a corner now, and if he has, this staff gets pretty formidable, like I mentioned, because we haven't talked about Danny Duffy, but he has been lights out since he's been back from the DL. He had another outstanding outing over the weekend. So the rotation, which has been really kind of shaky all year, is starting to round into shape and just in time.
What's the fallout from Cueto coming aboard? Obviously, a move has to be made to make room for him.
And it's either going to be Chris Young or Jeremy Guthrie, and you gun to my head, you know, Chris Young has experience in the bullpen. Jeremy doesn't. So, you know, well, of course, Chris Young's going to pitch tomorrow night. Now, if he goes out and throws 7 shutout innings and gives up one hit, what do you do then? But it's a good decision to have. Someone will have to come off the 25-man, too, and that's not going to be easy. But there's no one with options who can go out. So it's probably, you know, you might lean toward a Joe Blanton like that. So, but who knows what will happen then. Ned won't have to make that rotation decision until next week, so he's going to sit back like they always do and let the situation work itself out, you know. And well, so he's not going to make that decision today or tomorrow or the next day. It'll be next week.
You know, and every manager says that, and then it always happens. And
it is
not,
amazing.
And not to make light of the Jason Vargas situation, but just before that, they were saying things work themselves out, and then he pulls up lame with the elbow. It's crazy how this game sometimes does resolve itself that way. And ultimately, you want to be in a position where you have the hard decisions, really.
Yeah, and you want to have the depth to be able to cover that stuff, and they do. And they still have Chris Bedlin, too, if they ever would need that. So they've really got 7 starters and in pretty good shape.
Yeah, I talked to Lorenzo Cain just about the Cueto trade a little bit. He said, what is the mood, the emotion, I guess, when a team makes a splash like that? And for him, he's like, you know, we were pretty confident before we got him, so it's kind of like icing on the cake for their perspective. Sometimes a team needs that external boost, and okay, now we're really in this, but obviously the way their year has gone, they've been feeling pretty good about themselves all year.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I mean, I didn't think, when we talked last week, they really needed to make a deal. Dayton even said it's not a must that we do. They're 21 games over 500. They're 7.5 games in the lead. They've got a pretty solid group. There aren't any holes on this team. They've covered for the loss of Alex Gordon. They've covered for the loss of Jason Vargas. I think what this just does is icing on the cake, but it's also, if I'm an opponent now trying to face the Royals, I'm going, whoa, where are the holes in the rotation now? Just because you move a number one guy in there, and Ventura was trying to be a number one guy, and Danny Duffy is starting to act like a number one guy. So, and actually, to be honest, Eddie Volquez has been the number one guy this year. He's taken over for Shields, and he's been better than James Shields. So, you know, that's a pretty decent rotation we're looking at.
What do you think is clicked for Duffy here in the second half?
What is what?
What do you think has clicked for Duffy here in the second half?
I think just being healthy. You know, he had that biceps tendonitis, and I think it was bugging him. And he's come back, and he's changed his rotation. I mean, his delivery a little bit, where he's coming up a little bit more over the top. When he's missing north and south, more so than east and west. And he just feels more comfortable with that motion. And of course, as you know, the game is a lot of confidence building, and he's gotten 5 straight really good starts. And he's feeling, this is how he pitched last year. This is who he was. And we're seeing it again this year. And the Royals are going to hope you can see it through October.
Royals obviously in a very good spot in the Central Division now, the way that's shaken up. The Twins have not played particularly well in the second half. We know about the Tigers situation. They might even turn out to be sellers before this deadline. And the Indians and White Sox certainly have not asserted themselves the way a lot of people expected. So you look at it and you don't, you know, count your eggs before their hats, that kind of thing. But certainly they're in a good position where they could be, you know, kind of setting themselves up for October as we get late in the year. There could still be moves made with an eye on how it impacts this club in October, maybe not even necessarily in the division race. And by that, I mean they could still support this lineup a little more. I know there's talk about various, I mean, Ben Zobrist would help any contender. It would certainly help this one. Martin Prado is another versatile guy who you could play at various spots. What are your thoughts here with the deadline? Still a few days away, and it's obviously a fluid situation, but do you think they might have another move in there?
I think they might. I mean, they've been in love, like all teams have been, with Ben Zobrist for a long time. And he fits the bill, but what they want him to do would be a super utility guy who could give guys rest all around the infield, maybe in the outfield too. And I don't think they're done. I mean, I don't think that Dayton really wants to just crush his farm system, so he's going to be a little bit careful about that. But look, that would be another huge addition, and you've got 4 days for that to happen. I think what Dayton also wants to do is get the, you mentioned the Central Division, he wants to get a big enough lead where they can start resting some guys.
So right.
Guys like Sal Perez, if they got a 10-game lead with 2 weeks left, he could start playing every other day. They can just get really rested for the playoffs, which they were not last year.
Right.
Miraculously, they got all the way to Game 7, but it took its toll because Sal Perez was really not hitting very well in the postseason. He was just tired. Eskie got tired. I mean, they all got tired, but... If they get a big enough lead, and if they get a guy like Zobrist and they keep winning and run away with the division, it really sets them up for October.
Were you surprised that Brandon Finnegan was, I mean, obviously he had to be involved in this deal to get it done, but for them to move him, obviously a guy who is a big chip for them, were you surprised they did go that route?
Yeah, I think that was the hardest decision to make in that trade. The other guys, John Lamb and Cody Reed, you know, John Lamb had Tommy John surgery 4 years ago, and it just started to come back and pitch well again. The long road back for him. And Cody Reed's a young guy, just a second round pick a couple years ago. But Finnegan, you know, a big part of what they did last year, a big part in September, and pitched pretty well in the playoffs too. You know, they still had visions of him being a starter down the road, but you know, you got to give up somebody to get something. And he was the guy that the Reds wanted. And I know that was a hard decision for Dayton and staff, but. And to get a guy like Cueto, sometimes you got to do that. And another thing they like to say, and all GMs say too, hey, they haven't abolished the draft. There'll be another one next year, and they can keep, you know, stockpiling the farm system with more drafts. So that's their feeling. They can live without Brandon Finnegan. They didn't feel they could live without Johnny Cueto right now.
All right. Well, they got their man, and really set off a lot of alarms here at the trade deadline. The Royals. Nice to see the Royals proactive, not just content with their central lead, but. Really wanting to go out there and get that fourth win in the World Series this year. So I want to thank Jeffrey Flanagan for joining us.
We are just a few days away from the trade deadline. The Twins have not been a team discussed much with regard to that deadline. Let's bring in Rhett Bollinger to talk about basically the state of the Twins. Rhett, they've coming out of the All-Star break, they've had three straight series losses, two against fellow contenders in the American League. So what are your thoughts on the Twins here? I know you said in the past that if they did do anything at this deadline, it might be, you know, maybe some small additions to the bullpen. But what are your thoughts in general on the state of this club here in the second half?
It's been a little bit of a tough opening for the Twins to open the second half. Starting out in Oakland, you know, they come up with a big win and beat Sonny Gray. And the next day, they scored, you know, two runs in the ninth, thinking they are going to steal away another win against the A's. But sure enough, Glenn Perkins blows that save. And they ended up losing that series to the A's. Faced a hot Angels team and lost the first two games, and then had a nice win, a great performance from Irvin Santana against his former team. And the Yankees come in town, kind of like the A's series, where they win the first game. Second game, looks like they've got it wrapped up. They're up 5-0. A-Rod happens, and A-Rod hits three home runs, including a tie home run in the ninth there to tie it up. So it was one of the things where against Perkins blew a second save. So it's been kind of rough. There's been some tough losses here in the second half. I don't think the Twins are ready to panic or anything yet. They still got a little bit of homestand here, you know, facing the Pirates and Mariners before heading off on another road trip. So it's still early in the second half. They're not really panicking, but we'll see what they do at the deadline here. Likely to probably add a reliever, too, is probably the most likely thing to happen here. So not ready to panic for the Twins, but definitely not the opening they thought of to start the second half.
Yeah, you mentioned Perkins. He's had a couple hiccups here in the second half after a perfect first half. But really, in general, it's been a rough stretch for the bullpen at large. How big of a concern is that, and you know, might that spur movement here at the deadline?
It's definitely a concern. I mean, that's definitely their biggest kind of point of emphasis. Their biggest priority is upgrading that bullpen. Throughout the year, they got, you know, some guys like Blaine Boyer and Aaron Thompson have great starts for the year, and since then they've kind of fallen off a little bit. You know, Boyer has kind of lost his setup role to Casey Feen, who's also struggling a little bit there. Thompson's at AAA. Ryan O'Rourke, who came up, had a good start to his career with a couple of good outings, but then had another rough one in New York, against New York. So, yeah, the bullpen right now, other than Perkins, really nobody's really that dependable. And Perkins even, you know, has blown two of the last three saves now coming out of the break. So that's kind of the one of the big issues right now, is just trying to figure out this bullpen. Because the big thing, even when those guys were kind of rolling, was this isn't really a bullpen that strikes a lot of guys out. So when they get into these jams, or even come into a jam, you know, with inherited runners, they don't get enough strikeouts to really get out of a lot of these jams. So
right.
I think a kind of a power arm that could get some strikeouts, a power arm or even two, I think would be a big impact for this Twins team. But they don't also want to give up too much. They don't want to mortgage their future just to kind of get some relief help now especially help that's kind of a rental, just because they know that they're, you know, they're looking to compete longer than this season. I think this season was more of a surprise that they actually are still competing, so I don't think this team really wants to give up much of their future, say a guy like Oswaldo Arcia, you know, for just a relief help, just because, you know, we kind of want to, you know, sell the future just to kind of help win today with just relief help.
Yeah, it is tough because they are a little bit ahead of schedule, but at the same time, hey, they're one of only five teams in the American League that entered the week with a record north of 500. So it's some pretty rare territory here this year overall. But obviously, Rhett, you know, the rotation's been a big key to the Twins' newfound relevance here this season, and of course it'll be the big key for them moving forward with the rest of the year. And Erwin Santana has been very sharp in his four starts. He's 2-0 with a 2.6 ERA and eight shutout innings against the Angels last week. I don't know if we'd seen him that good since his 2011 no-hitter for the Angels. So just discuss what you've seen from Santana since coming back from the suspension.
He's been really sharp. He's had that one bad start he had. Outside of that, he's been really good. You know, his first start of the season, he faces another former team in the Royals. He goes eight innings. He gives up two runs. You know, the other start was kind of hurt by some home runs, I think, against the Tigers. Outside of that, he's been really sharp. I mean, that Angels start was pretty impressive. A lot of strikeouts in that start, too, and his velocity was really good. His velocity, he was sitting, you know, 95 miles per hour and occasionally touching 96, and then that slider was just, you know, guys had no chance against it. Which is funny because when he was in Oakland, he also had a really strong start there and pitched eight innings, I think, as well. So it was one of those things where he didn't really have much velocity in Oakland and only one strikeout. So the good news is he's kind of figured out ways to do it even on those days where he doesn't have his good stuff. So he's been a big addition to this pitching staff for sure, exactly what they were hoping for. And like I said, the eight innings, you know, he's gone, I think, seven, two-thirds, eight, and eight, and then the one bad start. So he's given them length, which helps the bullpen. He'll be counted on definitely in the second half. I mean, the tough part for the Twins is, you know, he's not eligible for the postseason because of the suspension. Right. Even if they were to make that one-game playoff, he's not even eligible for that. So that's kind of the tough thing, is knowing that all they can really get from him is those starts in the second half, but it's still a really big thing for this rotation. You know, we've seen some of the guys like Mike Calfrey fall off a little bit. He's at least coming off a strong start. And Kyle Gibson had a, you know, great, you know, finish to the first half. The second half, he struggled a little bit too. So, and Hughes has been a lot better. So I think in general, though, I think you kind of need to get this rotation going again. And I think that Santana's going to be a big part of that going forward.
How about Phil Hughes, Rhett? His outing against the Yankees the other day was his first start without giving up a home run in more than a month, I think, since the beginning of June. And it sounds like he used his changeup more. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. I think he used his changeup a little bit more. The pitch that he's kind of learning this year, and is still kind of in some situations a little bit afraid to use it. But I think you've seen some of the guys like Kyle Gibson. A lot of Gibson's success this year has been because he's kind of embraced that changeup. And that's the big thing that the new pitching coach, Neil Allen, really embraces, is that changeup, especially, you know, even righty on righty, which in the past, you know, is kind of a taboo thing just because it's so easy to get a home run, you know, righty on righty changeup if a guy gets out in front of it. But he was starting to use that a little bit more, was very effective against the Yankees. And even the home runs he's allowed, I think the last 10, obviously he's given up a lot of them, but I want to say the last 10 home runs he's given up have all been solo shots. So at least he's kind of given up home runs with nobody on base, or maybe he's challenging hitters when he's got a little bit of a lead to work with, a little bit of a cushion, and not really, you know, giving up the big three-run home runs that are costing him. At least he's kind of given up those solo shots where it's just the one run. But definitely a little bit of a concern just because the home run rate last year was so good. And that was kind of his issue in New York a few years ago, was the home run rate. And all of a sudden now it's kind of back at that level. But if you look at his overall ERA over the last, say, 9 or 10 starts, and he's been really solid. He's kind of really picked it back up kind of where he left off last year. He hasn't quite been as good, you know, in terms of last year breaking that record for strikeout to walk ratio, but he's still been very effective, you know, number two type starter, maybe number three type starter. Still take that going forward. But definitely the home run rate, if you can keep the ball inside the stadium, it's definitely going to help the rest of the season.
Byron Buxton's been out a few weeks now with that sprained left thumb. I know there's somewhat of an update on him, him doing some key work and flip drills, but it also sounds like he's not especially close to returning. Is that right, Rhett?
Yeah, exactly. He's got a big plan laid out for everything he needs to do. The good news is he's kind of getting back into baseball activities. The other day, he was swinging the bat underwater, which I don't think I've ever heard of before, but if that works, you know, more power to him. But those type of things, or at least he's kind of swinging the bat. He can play catch now with no issues, that kind of thing. So they'll kind of ramp him up. I believe he's supposed to head out to Fort Myers, Florida, to kind of work out here pretty soon now. and get kind of back into it. And then he'll probably go on a pretty lengthy rehab assignment just to kind of get it going, especially because he did struggle, too, at the majors, you know, when he was up there. Still want his back to kind of get going before he gets called back up. So, yeah, it sounded like he's probably, you know, about 2 to 3 weeks away still at the very least, potentially longer, kind of depending on how he goes with that rehab assignment. So he's still a little while away. The good news is that it healed properly in the fact that he's at least back to baseball activities. But it is taking maybe a little bit longer than expected, but he's not like he's too far off the timetable. And it wasn't like he suffered any setbacks. They're just being careful with him because they don't want him to, you know, re-aggravate that injury.
Yeah, if you could do the underwater swings and then run on the anti-gravity treadmill, that would be one heck of a workout, I think. And one last thing about Torrey Hunter tying Kirby Puckett's home run mark as a twin. That would be a special moment for him.
Absolutely, it really was. I mean, it meant a lot to him. I mean, he was, you know, he was even kind of sad passing him in the home run list just because he's so close with him. He knew him so well as a player, as a young player. That was kind of his idol, a guy that he looked up to. So it's kind of cool. Even and Kirby Puckett's son was there and met with the media and talked with us and talked about, you know, how special it was of all people that Torrey would do that just because they were so close. I mean, and that's the way Torrey is now with these younger guys, guys like Aaron Hicks and Byron Buxton in spring training and now, you know, in the major league roster, those guys just flocked to him. And that's how Torrey was in spring training with Kirby. Kirby was at the tail end of his career, and Torrey was just a youngster, but it was someone that Torrey really looked up to and really kind of, you know, a lot of things that Torrey's become as a player and as a person, I think, is just kind of emulating how Kirby was. And being around him as a Twins player, as a young player, he's always talked about that being a big influence on his career. So for him to do that meant a lot to him. He's kind of emotional, so it's definitely a really cool moment to see that.
All right, and obviously, Hunter joined the cause. You expected maybe some milestone moments like that, but didn't necessarily expect him to be so relevant and the Twins to be so relevant. So we'll see if they can make it a nice end to this 2015 story as we go along here in the second half. I want to thank Rhett Bollinger for joining us to talk about all that. I'm joined by old Beck, Jason Beck. And it's been an interesting month for the Detroit Tigers, to say the least. We are coming up on the trade deadline. Tigers are one of the more fascinating teams at this deadline from the standpoint that they could add, they could sell for the first time in years. And if they did sell, of course, as we've talked on this podcast the last couple of weeks, they would have some huge pieces to deal. Beck, I mean, it's obviously a complicated equation. On the one hand, the Tigers, they start out the season 9-1. They are 10 games under 500 since that point, as we sit here today. So, you know, and then on the other hand, there's just the mediocrity of the American League in general and the prevailing thought that, you know, a lot of teams can still get in that wild card mix. So as we enter the week of the trade deadline, what are your thoughts?
I think, the sense I get is I wouldn't be surprised if we were sitting here talking a lot like this in a couple of days. I get the sense that this really could go right down to, you know, the latter days of the week and the hours leading up to the deadline before we really get a clear demonstration of what these guys want to do. You know, there are people who really want to wait as long as they can to try to see a direction from this team and see if there's a sign of hope that that they can really make a run at. And like you said, as up and down as things have been and as disappointing as Boston ended up being, you know, these guys are still, you know, just four games out from the wild card with a lot of matchups against Minnesota coming up and with a big series in Houston coming up next month. So yeah, this is still a team that in a lot of ways, even with the position that they're in, they have a lot of control over their fate in, you know, not just on the field, but in the front office.
Yeah, they really do. And of course, you know, a big factor there is Miguel Cabrera. He started to take batting practice, I believe, Beck. And obviously they're hoping to get him back in the middle of August, which again, I keep coming back to just this league is so unpredictable right now. You mentioned the Twins. Obviously, they're still ahead of them, but they have not played well in the second half. Really, that wild card chase is so up in the air. We've seen it all season where teams go on little mini hot streaks and then pull back. And obviously, I think a lot of us are resigned to the effect of the Royals winning the AL Central here this season. They're in a very good position to do so, especially now they had a giant Cueto. But from the wild card perspective, especially once Miggy comes back, that's obviously in the back of the Tigers' mind.
Yeah, and I think Cabrera has the potential to be a huge factor. And just I keep coming around to the idea that if Miguel Cabrera is fighting this hard to come back earlier than some people might have predicted, he's taking BP. I believe he's getting some work in at first base. He's showing every sign that he wants to try to come back as soon as possible. If he's willing to put in that work and put in another late season where he's grinding it out, potentially in, you know, discomfort again, trying to win, is this organization going to say no to him and give up the ship? This is a guy who's gone to great lengths for this franchise and his owner to work through a lot of issues late in the year, the last few years, to try to give this team a chance to win. And if anybody would be able to sway ownership, if any one player could ever sway ownership on something like this, I think it would be Cabrera, just with what he's demonstrated the last few years.
Obviously, when we talk about the Tigers' big trade chips, the two linchpins there are Yoenis Cespedes and David Price. Cespedes, Beck, you were talking about this last week, the unusual clause in his contract where he can't receive a qualifying offer and therefore is not tied to draft pick compensation at the end of the year. You know, maybe that enters into the Tigers' minds as they make this sell or not to sell equation. But and he would, of course, fetch a nice prize for them, just being one of those rare, you know, power bats that are hard to acquire this time of year. And then Price, I want to dig into him for a second here because his agent, Bo McInnes, talked to MLB Network Radio over the weekend. And in addition to saying what you said, Beck, that this thing will probably go down to the wire with the trade deadline, he also kind of confirmed what a lot of us assume, that the Tigers and Price are in very different places with regard to an extension. Now, obviously, with Price, there's the draft pick issue, which can, give the Tigers some value should he leave in free agency. But you see the Johnny Cueto trade, and the Reds, I thought, did very well in that trade, for a rental and B, a guy who, you know, has had some elbow issues here this season, has had a couple starts pushed back. With Price, you got an even better track record. You've got no health concerns whatsoever. So you have to assume that as good as the Reds did in that trade, getting three young lefties, highlighted by Brandon Finnegan, you think the Tigers could do even better for Price. So what are your thoughts on David Price's market here as we get closer to the deadline?
Yeah, I mean, I was interested to see the trade return for Cueto, and I was pretty impressed with what Walt Jocketty was able to do there. I wonder if the difference in the franchises that are interested in Price or would be interested in Price compared with the Royals, how the prospect depth would play into effect there. The Dodgers, if you believe the accounts, and there are a lot of them, but they would be in big time on Price. They don't have the same depth in terms of prospects, it would seem like, but the prospects they have are awfully intriguing. And you could see the Tigers, making a big push if they were to sell, or even playing this whole we're on the fence thing to try to pry one of those big-time prospects away from the Dodgers to try to get that package that would help them not only down the road, but maybe even sooner rather than later. Cubs, same boat. The Cubs have some awfully interesting players there. Cespedes, just from talking with folks, I don't get the impression that contract clause is going to have as big of an effect as some people think it will, because if Cespedes is interested in sticking around, as reported, and if the Tigers were interested in keeping it, it shouldn't take that long after the season to figure out how far or how close either side would be on making the deal. It shouldn't take that long to figure out what the financial ramifications would be. I seem to remember them going through this with Johnny Peralta after I traded for him, they were able to negotiate an extension pretty quickly after the season ended. Like, I think they were able to get something done that year, even before the end of the postseason, because the Tigers didn't make it that year, I don't think. Beyond that, too, I know the Anibal Sanchez drama played out into the offseason, and his agent was able to use the market to get a better deal. And well, that could be what just because his agents end up doing, and that's what, you know, that's what they're paid to do. But that said, if the Tigers really want Cespedes, and if Cespedes really has an interest in sticking around, I would think that 5 days would be enough for both sides to figure out where the other is at and figure out if this thing is doable. I just don't think that that's going to be a major factor as far as motivating the Tigers, whether to trade him and then try to keep him, or even with another team, maybe trying to acquire him. Because if it was a big deal, would that affect another team trying to acquire him if they were interested in keeping him long term?
Cespedes will be a really interesting free agent for me. Just, you know, there's that low on base percentage that might scare off some teams and are more. You know, you think about what Shin-Soo Choo did, largely on the basis of his OBP, scoring a 7-year, $130 million deal with the Rangers. You know, Cespedes can't do that based on his OBP, but maybe he can do it based on his power. It's hard to say, but obviously the Tigers have a great amount of money committed to their middle of the order with the Cabrera contract and the V-Mart contract, and even J.D. Martinez about to get a nice salary spike in his next two rounds of arbitration. So some tough decisions ahead there. And Beck, let's just flip this on its head. And if this thing were to go the complete other way and the Tigers were to try to add on at this deadline, which is always a possibility with Dave Dombrowski, what are they realistically in a position to do, in your opinion?
Realistically, I don't think they have the prospect to make a deal for a big time off. I mean, in terms of the starter, it was, I know a lot of people talk about a buyer's market, and I think that's something the Tigers would have to rely on to pull off a deal. I could see them getting one of those second-tier starters. Tyson Ross would seem interesting. You know, somebody of that ilk. It would make sense for them, maybe more so than some other teams, maybe more so than in previous years, to try to get a guy who's under control beyond the season, even if it costs them a little bit more. Because I just, even with their situation in terms of, you know, payroll considerations and concerns, if they can get some rotation certainty for next year, given what, by all indications, looks like a very questionable, you know, short-term future for Shane Greene, given the struggles. And some questions about some of their other starting prospects here. Yeah, it would behoove them, if they could, to get a starting pitcher who would give them a little bit more depth for next year and not just an extra arm for this one. To me, I still think they have to look at least getting some middle relief depth there. Even if you're happy with Joaquin Soria closer, I think you've got to be able to shore up the 7th and 8th innings. There's a lot of different candidates you can look at to do that. Maybe some of them aren't flashy. Maybe the guys the Tigers could afford aren't flashy guys, but if you can find somebody who can get the job done, I think that's something the Tigers would want to jump at if they can. And that's something that could well go down to the wire, too. We saw last year that they were beating out for Andrew Miller because they didn't have that prospect like Eduardo Rodriguez to be able to throw at the Red Sox. It would seem to me that they're in the same boat this year. But that doesn't mean that you can't throw some other prospect and get a guy who can at least, if not dominate, at least be serviceable there to give Brad Austin some options so that he's not having to kind of play out Alex Wilson at both ends, where you've got to keep him reserved for extra innings in close game, but at the same time, you want to be able to use him in tight situations as kind of a secondary setup option.
All right. Obviously, a very fluid situation with the Tigers as they explore the limits of the trade deadline season.
Special edition of MLB.com Extras. We got Jordan Bastian, as we do every week. We got Andre Knapp.
Yeah.
Fox Sports Ohio joining us here. We are in the dugout at Progressive Field.
Are we going to rub his head before we do this? It seems to be.
Oh, you guys are already winning. You don't need me.
We got a lot of fight in us here on this dugout, but there's some question right now about the Tribes fight. Jason Kipnis had some pointed remarks to that end. He said they're playing poorly. I think that's how we phrased it on the site. We didn't use the word he used. He used a stronger word. JB, I'll start with you. What did you think of those remarks? And I mean, when you get swept by the White Sox in a four-game series, it's pretty natural for some frustration to seep out.
Yeah, I thought he didn't say anything that maybe the fan base wasn't already thinking. You know, we've had a few situations this season where that's happened, whether it's Trevor Bauer earlier in the year, Kipnis last night, you know, even Francona when we were in Tampa Bay talked about the team meeting he held there. You know, obviously there's been a few stretches where, you know, it looked like this team was going to get rolling, and then it's taken a step backwards, you know, and they're trying right now, you know, as the trade deadline approaching and getting down to the last 2 months, you know, they really need to kick it in gear. I think they're only 6.5 out of the second wild card, so while that's, you know, not inconceivable, you know, they got to get things going here if they want to be the team that they were supposed to be. And I think that was kind of the message from what I understand last night was, you know, can they all look in the mirror right now and say this is the team they want to be? And obviously the answer is no. So maybe they got to do a little bit better policing in the clubhouse, holding guys accountable. Maybe Tito has got to do a better job of also holding these guys accountable. And I think that was the overwhelming message. And I think Kipnis in his remarks kind of made that pretty apparent.
Dre, you've got a kind of a special vantage point. You travel with this club. You really are immersed in their day-to-day. And obviously this season has not unfolded the way a lot of people expected, and certainly not the way the Indians wanted. But what's your perception of that fire and that energy that we're talking about?
I think Jordan hits on a lot of great points. I think the one thing that stands out to me is that you have a talented team, but it's very young. And I think leadership from a player perspective, it's difficult right now because you kind of look around that clubhouse and you go, okay, Michael Bourne's played for a long time, but he struggled this season, let's be honest. Hard to lead when you're trying to get yourself back to normal. Nick Swisher, a guy I think that a lot of people thought of as a leader, has been in and out because he's been dealing with injuries. And you have a guy in Jason Kipnis who is building himself and growing into that leadership, but at the same time, kind of finding himself still as a player after going through what he went through last year. So I think you have a locker room, you know, full of guys that want to lead. And then you have a pitching staff, and I'll mention this too. There are a lot of talented guys, but they're all very young. And you're going to have ups and downs, and I think confidence plays a huge role in this. And I think what piqued a little interest this past weekend is nothing against the White Sox, but this team played very well against the White Sox throughout the season. You look at all the numbers of the White Sox, and it pointed towards, hey, we should have this is a team that we can play well against. And the White Sox got confidence, start playing really well. It snowballed. And I think on the other side of the clubhouse, they're going, wait a minute, that's what we're supposed to be doing to them. You know, like, they're the team that had, you know, had scored less runs than we had scored. They're the team that's struggling and was in the basement. And I think that opened a lot of eyes to guys of, hey, we've got to play different. And I think when you, and this isn't taking anything away from the White Sox, because I think the key word to all of this is confidence. They played with confidence over the weekend at Progressive Field, and the Indians, for whatever reason, it was hard to play with confidence. And I know that Saturday night game where you give up 5 runs against Carlos Carrasco in the first inning, and you don't have Kipnis in, and Sales on the mound. And one thing Kipnis said that stood out to me that a lot of people didn't run with, he said 2 years ago when we got down against a guy like Chris Sale, it was like, hey, let's make this hard on him. He may beat us, but let's make it hard on him. And he goes, he felt like we didn't do that the other night. And I think that's where a lot of this meeting came from. And I'll go back to it, and Jordan knows this better than I. Mr. Giambi played a huge role on this team that we never put in the box score. And I just haven't seen anyone fill that role yet. And I think that's kind of, that's the hump that they have to get over, in my opinion.
Yeah, I'd have to go, I mean, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but there has been that feel with this club this year. It seems like you can count on one hand the number of games that they legitimately mounted a comeback, you know, in late in the game. They just don't have that, they haven't had that fight much this year. And let's face it, guys, this is a bad time to play bad, you know, because there are some big decisions being made off of not off a small sample by any means, but you know, if you're trending a certain way this time of year, it can really force a general manager's hand. And Chris Antonetti, we know he's, like every general manager, he's having active discussions with other clubs. We've seen some reports out there, not just about a short-term asset like a David Murphy or a Brandon Moss or a Ryan Rayburn, but we've even seen Carlos Carrasco's name out there, which would be a pretty dramatic statement, maybe not so much about this season, but just, you know, if they were to entertain his value at this point, that would catch a lot of people off guard, I think. But JB, what are your thoughts on Cookie Carrasco's, I guess, and not just him, but this young starting group in general, if they were to deal from that strength to address something, obviously it'd be a long-term move.
Yeah, I think on the surface, you'd make a move like that with one of those starting pitchers, and I think the fans immediately take it as, well, this season's over. But I think right now everyone's looking for starting pitching. And when you have a guy like Carrasco at his age and his ability locked in for as long as he is at the very team-friendly price that he is, I think it's just due diligence on the Indians' part to take that phone call and see if there's a team that's willing to, you know, really go all in and oversell to the point where it's like, well, we really can't pass this up, especially when we have the foundation with the other starters that they do have. So I think, while I don't expect that trade to come to fruition, and I believe the report with the Blue Jays was that it fell apart, and now that the Indians have indicated that they're not willing to trade Carrasco, obviously anything can happen, but I would be stunned. I think what you're more likely to see are some of those guys who maybe aren't a part of the long-term future, guys like David Murphy, Ryan Rayburn, guys who could be role players on other teams. You know, those would be the guys that the Indians would look to shop, because if they're not going to be part of the future, you know, maybe you can see if you can get something in return for them right now.
You know, Jordan hit on something. You're not doing your due diligence as a general manager if you don't take the phone calls to find out. What if a Toronto was willing to give up their whole farm system for a guy like Carrasco, for a guy like Salazar? I'm not saying you do it, because I think the one thing I'll give the Indians credit for is that they've said, we're going to build ourselves on pitching. And they've built a pretty young nucleus of pitchers that you could say for the, you know, for the next 3-4 years, they should be able to depend upon them, you know, barring injury or anything else. But at the same time, don't you have to find out the worth of what, the guys that you have? I think in anything in life, you have to find out your worth. And I think that's really what was being done. I think Jordan's completely right. Some parts and pieces maybe move. Maybe not even on July 31st. Maybe a month from now when we see that happen. I think that's, and you mentioned this, Anthony, I think you're right. It's just the time of the year. Like if they were playing like this in May, it'd be like, a lot of time. But now we start talking about, and even Kipnis said this, he goes, stop bringing up the wild card. But it's that second wild card has changed. Hasn't it changed in every city? You guys, it changes all of our thought process. It was like, it used to be, let's get to 500, you know, and then let's see where we're at. Now it's, you're 5 out, you're 6 out, you know, 1 good week, you're right back in it. And I think that's great for baseball, but I think it makes the general manager's job harder, and I think it makes managers' jobs a little bit harder, and I think players grind a little bit more, because now not only do you look at the top of the AL Central, now you hit that other button on MLB.com of wild card, you're like, well, we're still in it.
Nice plug. Yeah, I like that plug.
Hey, I've worked in a lot of places. I get it.
Well, I got to tell you, when the best team in the American League is in your division and they add Johnny Cueto, maybe you start to think about wild card even more. But
absolutely.
Now, for Carrasco, you know, he's definitely not a guy I would have gone into July thinking they have to deal this guy. But you almost do think about it a little bit. I mean, yes, he has a very team-friendly deal, but you also look at the incidence of guys with repeat Tommy Johns. You think about, he had Tommy John 4 years ago.
Remember
how long is that ligament old at? I don't
know.
Remember
the story from the beginning of the year, too. Not to cut you off.
Oh, you're right.
But then when he signed and we started hearing about his heart situation. You got to do your due diligence.
Yeah, it's not a totally crazy, out-of-this-world scenario to think that you parlay a guy whose value is at, maybe at its height. Who knows? All right, let's wrap things up here, guys. The Larry Doby statue over the weekend, that was a big moment for this organization. A guy, JB, you and I have written about quite a bit. Dre, I'm sure you discussed him quite a bit. You know, of course, does not get the recognition of a Jackie Robinson, whose number is retired across the spectrum of the game. And, you know, didn't get the recognition even at the time so much as a function of what market he played in and things of that nature. And also his own personality. He wasn't as out there as Jackie Robinson, but good to see him well represented here at this ballpark.
Yeah, I think obviously, as we talk about many times, long overdue, but you know, it's done now, and it's great to see that statue out there. To see the three statues together, it's pretty cool to walk out there and kind of see the different eras being honored from the Indians' history. And obviously, Dobie represents more than just the Indians. It's a very milestone figure for baseball, and you know, broke down the barrier in the American League. And you're right. I think Mr. Dolan had a good comment about, you know, the second guy who walked on the moon doesn't get a lot of the credit. You know, the people don't really remember him. And it's kind of the same thing with Larry Doby. You know, he kind of gets overlooked in the grand scheme of things, but his story is just as remarkable, and I'm really glad to see that finally happen, and to see all the people who came out, you know, from the Doby family, his former teammate, former traveling secretary. It was a great, great moment for this team, for this franchise, and for baseball.
I remember Buzz Aldrin on The Simpsons once. He said,
"Oh yeah,
second comes right after first."
That's right. Right.
But you got to interact with the Doby family, right?
Long overdue. Yeah. Let me say that first and foremost. But I thought the Indians did it right once they did it. Heck, right now as we do this, and I don't know when this will go up, Larry Doby Jr. is out shagging flies, wearing a Doby. And I'll go to that. Terry Francona, I thought, handled this so well. The one story he told about his dad being traded, actually, for Larry Doby twice. Oh, yeah. Twice, he said, I had to look it up because, you know, I wasn't alive when it happened. But it's true. But I thought and you guys know how baseball goes, and I think most people, it's very regimented. No matter what sport you're covering, it's very regimented day to day. Like, we're going to do this at this time, we're going to do this. He had his whole team dressed and ready to go and made sure they were out there. And I thought that was, and talking to his family members and the people at the Doby, they were blown away that the whole roster's out here dressed and, you know, ready to go. I thought the Indians did a great job with it. And I think, really now, when you go out to that Heritage Park and when you see Feller and you see Larry Doby, not only does it speak of what the Indians' history is, but it's a little bit of American history. You know, and what's happened in this country and what's happened in this town. Well, like I said, long overdue, but I thought it was beautiful how everything carried out and how everything was done. And for me, the whole thing with a statue, and you guys are parents, to me, when you take a kid to the Hall of Fame or whatever, you want to be able to look at a statue and say, this person was important because of this.
Right.
And it's great that Jim Thome hit 500 home runs. It was a great part of the 90s for the Indians. But I think when you look at those other two statues, you can tell your son, your daughter, their story, and your kid's going to walk away and go, wow. You know, like, that's pretty huge. And the Indians were a huge part of that. I thought the best quote from Larry Doby Jr. was that, hey, you know, this is a statue for the Doby family, but also for the city of Cleveland, for how they opened their arms to us in a time when it wasn't popular to do that.
Hey, let's not sell Larry Doby Jr. short either. Longtime roadie for Billy Joel.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know if he's still working for me, but for a long time he
was.
That's
a gig right there.
How about that? Yeah. All right, we got some pretty sweet gigs, too. I want to thank Andre Knott for joining us as a special guest.
I am joined by the handsome Scott Merkin. Merk, we're getting close to the trade deadline, of course, Friday at 4 o'clock Eastern. I see Larry King is opining on what's going to happen at this deadline for the White Sox. He predicts a trade between the Dodgers and White Sox. What do you think? Is Mr. King onto something there?
Well, you know, I mean, Larry King has some connections to the White Sox, and he also has big Dodgers diehard, very frequent visitor of Camelback Ranch, where the Sox and Dodgers share a spring training facility, so you can't dismiss it. I think the Sox are pretty much, they're always in listening mode, and not just at the trade deadline. They're always open for something that can improve them now and in the future. But, you know, a little interesting turn over the weekend with the four-game sweep over the Indians, and again, it's something that Rick Hahn's got to decide if it's kind of, you know, and I'm using the word that he used last year, which is kind of figure out if it's fool's gold or if it's really something that's turned around, and see what happens. I think basically the main guy, barring some kind of surprise, that could go is Jeff Samardzija. That's because he's a free agent at the end of the year. So aside from that, I don't see a lot of other stuff happening for the White Sox, or at least movement from the White as sellers.
Yeah, they've definitely good time to make it interesting for the front office, I guess. It's good headache to create if you can get them thinking through some things, because obviously a few days ago it looked like Samardzija was definitely a goner, you know, if there was any kind of action on him. But
here's the thing about this team, and this is no offense to the great team in the city of Cleveland, but you know, I'm not taking anything away from the White Sox, because they played probably their four best games back to back. I got them all in there, I think, of the season. But Cleveland looked pretty awful this weekend. So
they did.
You have to decide, was this really a turnaround? Because there was some offense for once. There was some clutch hitting. There was some great defense. The pitching has pretty much been there, I'd say, you know, three quarters of the season so far. or was it a really good run against a substandard team? And they have done this before this year. You know, they swept Houston at home, which is, you know, right now a pretty solid playoff team, getting better by the day, and then went and lost 8 in a row after that. And then before the All-Star break, they went 9-3 into that last game of the first half. Jake Arrieta shut them down, and then they went 1-5 to start the second half before they swept Cleveland. So you can look at it, you know, positive and say, man, they swept 4 in a row, and, you know, look at how well they're playing. Or you can say, well, they're 5-5 since the All-Star break overall. So it's you got to figure, even in parity, what is it? This is the biggest question, I think, for all these teams that are, you know, kind of hanging around 500 and hanging around the second wild card is, what is it worth to give up to play that one game? You know, yes, you can win that one game and go on a run like the Royals did, or you could give up a lot like the A's and be out in, you know, one day after the season ends. So that's what the Stags have got to figure out.
The thing for me with Samardzija and his market is, you know, yes, if you were acquiring Samardzija for the next 3-4 years, if that was what was at stake here at this trade deadline, then I absolutely go for it, you know. But you're acquiring him as a 2-month rental in a season where he's been about league average, and he clearly has some adjustments to make from a consistency standpoint. Now, granted, he was brilliant against the Indians the other night, and as you said, Merck, the Indians just looked brutal that whole weekend. But you know, he's not quite as bankable an asset for the stretch run as some of these other guys. You know, Cueto's had a nice year when healthy, or when not having starts skipped. And David Price, of course, if he's traded, you know, he's obviously top of that class. And there's so many arms who are available or who could potentially be available between now and Friday that I almost feel like it waters down the Samardzija market a little bit. And especially for the White Sox, who, A, might have a chance at extending him, or B, you know, can recoup that first-round draft pick, you know, should he sign elsewhere this winter. So, I don't know. I almost feel like they might be better off just riding out with the Shark, not knowing, of course, what kind of offers are coming in or what kind of discussions are being had. It just seems, you know, from the outside looking in, it just seems like the return package might not be quite as overwhelming as it was for, say, a Cueto.
Well, I think, you know, they're asking for, from what I've heard, they're asking for a main prospect and then some depth, which is what they kind of did with the Jake Peavy trade in 2013.
Right.
And don't, you know, be surprised if Rick gets creative again and does a three-team type of deal like he did, you know, as we're in Boston right here. He did with Peavy going to Boston and Jose Iglesias going to Detroit, and then obviously Ivo Garcia and now Frankie Montes, who's emerged as a pretty solid prospect, coming to the White Sox. I would say one thing about Samardzija is he's been much more consistent of late. If you look at his numbers, he's gone, I believe it's 9 straight starts. He's pitched at least 7 innings, and I think it's 12 of his last 13. And there's a couple where he gave up 5 or 6 runs. But you know what? That's a pretty valuable commodity to have, especially for a playoff team. You know, I mean,
right,
you got a guy who's helping the bullpen, and even on bad days, even on days that, you know, where he gives up 5 or 6 runs, he's still getting you into the 8th inning. You're in pretty good shape there, and you know, you're hanging close and having a shot to win. So, yeah, I think he's in that mix. I don't think he's, you know, David Price value, because David Price is probably gold standard in this whole market. You know, I don't know if he's, you know, Mike Leake, or if he's what Johnny Cueto, the Royals got, or the, I'm sorry, the Reds got for Johnny Cueto, but I think he's got an immense amount of value. And the Sox are, you know, I would be stunned if in the next couple of days or before the end of the season they announce that they've signed him to extension. Jeff Samardzija has been pretty consistent, you know, to his credit, from the moment it was getting close to free agency, that he is going to test the waters. You know, he's earned that right, and I don't blame him for not going out there. But he's also said that the Sox would still be in the mix, whether he was traded, whether he stayed here for the end of the year, whether they make the playoffs and go a long way, or they finish 78-84, they're in the mix. You know, I think he's enjoyed his time here. He's a Indiana kid. He likes to pitch on both sides of town already. You know, so I think they're still in the mix for that. But I don't expect an extension. And I think, you know, he will add to a playoff team. There's no question about it. If you don't have to put him at the number one spot in the rotation, which the Sox are not doing right now, you got a solid innings guy who, yeah, his strikeouts are a little down, but still, you know, a good, consistent guy every 5 days is going to help your team.
This is the kind of stuff you have to do this time of year just to cover your butt should something go down. They lined up Eric Johnson to make Tuesday start in case the Shark is dealt. What should we know about Eric Johnson in general, Merck, whether or not he takes the mound for them this week?
You know, assistant GM Buddy Bell, who I heard drew a mention from Craig Biggio in the Hall of Fame speech on Sunday, mentioned to us that they've been working with backwards with him and Frank Montas, Eric Cosmas, is because they, you know, they're two guys who almost certainly will be with the team at some point this year, whether it's Tuesday night or whether it's September or anywhere in between. And so they're kind of trying to figure out their inning, so they may skip him a little bit. But, you know, let's face it, he's lined up behind Samardzija to start. Eric Johnson was one of the top prospects, came up a couple years ago in September, three seasons ago in September, had a great run, was being counted on going into last year as, you know, really one of the top three guys in the rotation, and just had an awful year. There's no way to sugarcoat it. I think he'd say the same thing. You know, he made it five starts with the White Sox. He had an ERA above six. He had 20 more starts at Charlotte, an ERA almost at seven. Walked way too many guys. His velocity was down. And to his credit, he, you know, went home over the offseason. He kind of fixed some mechanics issues, and he's been great this year. And Buddy Bell made a comment that Eric Johnson is better now than when he was when they called him up as a prospect. Not last year, but when they called him up the first time as a prospect. So that's pretty good praise. Now, again, you know, no one's going to say, well, you know, he's all right, we really like him. You know, he's got a great personality, but he didn't have to go over, you know, the top and rave about that either. And, he, you know, Eric Johnson started the International League All-Star game, and he's really had a nice turnaround. I think people are anxious to see what he can bring now at the big league level. You know, he's had his first taste of failure and handled it pretty well, and now is ready to kind of get back up to the majors and show what he can do.
Talk about a guy bringing it at the major league level, and surprisingly so, as Tyler Saladino has taken over that third base spot and even prompted the trade of Connor Gillespie after a kind of a breakout season for Gillespie last year. It's a small sample, Merck, a handful of games, but you know, Saladino's obviously made an impact offensively and defensively. He's been very solid. Talk about this guy, really, from the external perspective, he seems to catch you off guard. How surprised are the White Sox by his development here?
Well, they liked him, and Robin in particular liked him. Robin, a few years ago, called him up, not, you know, called him officially, but asked Rick Hahn and Kenny Williams to bring him up for spring training, and he wasn't even a non-roster invite at that point. So they added him to the spring training roster by Robin's request. So I think, yeah, he's just a baseball player. There's really not much else you can do to describe it, but that, you know, I don't know if he's going to wow you with every skill set he has, but he just does the little things right. He catches everything hit over to him, and he's not really a natural third baseman. He's more a shortstop than a third baseman. You know, he has good speed, hits, you know, a good line drive hitter, knows how to hit behind the runner. He's a good two-hitter, and he just, you know, does everything well, and he likes to get out there and get dirty in the field, and he's just one of those guys that just helps your team. You know, I don't know if he's going to ever be giving a speech at Cooperstown in the distant future, but I don't think he has to help this White Sox team. He's been an immeasurable addition already just because he's catching everything over there. Now, Gordon Beckham also did a good job defensively. It was just an off year for Connor, and probably the change of scenery is going to end up helping him. But, you know, Gordon was catching the ball as well as anyone. Gordon's probably, you know, around the infield, maybe one of the better defensive infielders you can find, but he just wasn't hitting the ball. And now Tyler has gotten up to a good start offensively. Obviously, he's going to have to adjust when the league adjusts to him, but right now he's playing great, and he's been, you know, just kind of that burst of energy they needed since he joined them at Wrigley Field. And lucky for him, in, you know, his first month of the season, he's already playing road games at Wrigley in the Cubs Sox series, and now he's at Fenway for the first time in his life. And he told me he was real excited about getting to go inside the Green Monster and get a tour of the Green Monster there.
Well, Saladino, you don't think he's going to end up in Cooperstown. It's still too early to say if Chris Sale will end up in Cooperstown, but did a piece.
I like the transition.
Yeah, you like that? Did a piece the other day comparing Sale's career to Randy Johnson at the same number of starts. I believe it's 103 career starts. And Sale's got far better ERA, just better control is what it comes down to. Randy Johnson was, of course, very wild early in his career. And really, not until his age 28, 29 seasons did he really start to become the Randy Johnson we all know and love. But you had a chance to ask Chris Sale about that comparison. This is the guy he, you know, grew up idolizing and obviously bears somewhat of resemblance to on the mound just from the standpoint of being that lanky lefty with the crazy strikeout stuff. But what were his thoughts on that comparison, Merck?
Yeah, one thing about Randy Johnson is when it clicked for him, good Lord, it was over at that point, wasn't it? I mean, yeah, I know at the beginning, you know, hitters joked about they were terrified to face him because he's throwing 100 and didn't know where the heck the ball was going. But, man, once that guy figured it out, holy cow, no reason to bring a bat up there a lot of the times. And, you know, for Sale, it's pretty much clicked right from the get-go. And he's a real humble kid. And one of the reasons why he's become such a good leader for this team, even though, as he jokes, you know, he only plays once every 5 days. But he just, kind of laughs at that stuff. He's honored by it. You know, I asked him about the strikeout streak, you know, that he had, the double-digit strikeout streak, and he said, it's just kind of overwhelming to hear your name mentioned with Pedro Martinez and Randy Johnson and Nolan Ryan and that sort of thing. And the same thing about Randy Johnson. You know, he liked watching him pitch. He was one of his idols growing up. And he said, just to be mentioned in that is, you know, it's kind of crazy. You know, I talked to him the day before he got inducted into the Hall of Fame, and he was just saying, you know, we're talking about a guy who's going into the Hall, two guys who are going to the Hall of Fame tomorrow, when he mentioned Martinez and Johnson to be included in that group. So, but he doesn't really, he made a reference later on in my conversation to like a horse race where you just keep your blinders on and you keep moving forward and you don't look behind because you're not sure who's, you know, who could be catching you, and you don't look too far ahead because he said you can trip and fall. So he doesn't really get caught up in all the praise. Again, it's a big compliment to him and he gets a big kick out of it, but he knows the work he's got to do to continue progressing. And I mean, really, I don't know if you agree, Anthony, but probably one of what, top three or four starters in baseball right now, Mr. Chris Sale.
Absolutely. And I think, and I made this point in the piece, I mean, to do it after just 22 minor league appearances, all in relief, and then to come up to the big leagues and just instantly, I mean, obviously he was in the bullpen first, but to catch on as quickly as he did, you know, from a starting standpoint, it's just unbelievable. You just don't see that. Usually it's a slow progression. You know, guys not only have to progress at the minor leagues, but, you know, they have to find their way at the major league level. They have to find what works for them. And Sale just really a seamless transition. And again, yeah, who knows where his career goes from here, but you can't get off to much of a better start than Chris Sale has. So,
you know, we were talking to Robin yesterday about, you know, the guys he watched that had, like, the best stuff he's ever seen. And he mentioned that run that Eric Gagne was on, which, what, he saved 88 straight games, I want to say, where it was just, you know, embarrassing how good he was during the time. And, you know, Chris Sale, for part of that season where he was a full-time reliever, he was, you know, the short time at the year he got drafted and the year after he was a reliever, was, you know, a closer and did pretty well there. And you wonder if he would have stayed in a closer's role, would his arm have held up over that, and would he have become, you know, a 50-save guy every year with the kind of stuff he had? And think about that stuff in short doses, what it could do to hitters, you know, in the eighth or ninth inning, finishing things up. Pretty tough to hit, I would think.
Very tough to hit and very fun to watch. And, Merck, always very fun to listen to you talk White Sox during the podcast. It's the highlight of my week. All right, that's a wrap. It's been MLB.com Extras, American League Central Edition.